Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2012, today's guest, Norm Ornstein, co-wrote a book called It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. An essay adapted from the book ran in the Washington Post. That piece was called, Let's Just Say It. The Republicans are the problem. Ornstein and his co-author Thomas Mann argued that the Republican Party became an insurgent outlier in U.S. politics and called on the media to tell the truth about the party's extreme transformation. Stop with the both sides-ism. Joining us to discuss his thoughts 14 years later is Norm Ornstein, emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, contributing editor for The Atlantic, and co-host with Dr. Kavita Patel of the podcast Words Matter. In 2017, Norm Ornstein wrote another book with Thomas Mann, and this time with E.J. Dionne. It's called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, and the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. Hi, Norm. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Rose.
Well, you have been studying Washington politics and Congress for more than 50 years. Can you tell us, how did you first get involved in this work?
So I'm a political scientist, and I was getting my PhD at the University of Michigan. As was my friend of all these years, Tom Mann. We both came to Washington in 1969 as congressional fellows to work on Capitol Hill for a year. I then came back to teach and move into, ultimately, after about 15 years of teaching at universities, to move to a think tank. But during all that time, from when I first arrived, I really found myself immersed in the work of Congress, and then just as somebody kicking around Washington for a long time, who also, you know, did some television and wrote for newspapers, I got to know a whole lot of people who were key players in our political process, as well as those in journalism, and was able to not only interact with them, do a lot of work with them, a lot of it on congressional reform and broader political reform, reform of the voting system, and of the executive branch, civil service and the like. I saw things change. I worked with people, hundreds, literally, from both sides over the years. I started to make a list a little while ago of all the Republicans I had worked with closely and who were friends. And Tom and I, who did a lot of this work together, really, going back before 2012, starting with a book we wrote in 2006 called The Broken Branch, really had begun to see the political process moving in a direction that was deeply troubling, and it's only accelerated since.
Talk a little bit about when you first noticed the changes. When did that happen, and what stood out for you?
Sure. And let me note here, Rose, that I picked the title, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, because it never looks good. The political process is a messy one. It's not designed to come to conclusions easily and quickly and efficiently and smoothly. But even though it's always looked bad, I could see, really going back to a couple of years after George W. Bush became president, and especially when Dennis Hastert became the Speaker of the House, that we were moving in a very dysfunctional direction. Now, why Dennis Hastert? Well, remember that when he was Speaker, and he was chosen as Speaker after horrible set of scandals and problems among Republicans, they booted Newt Gingrich. We can come back to that. And then the next person who they expected to take the speakership, Bob Livingston. This was all around the time of, moving to impeach Bill Clinton over his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. Livingston, just before they voted on him, said that he had had an affair. They basically pushed him aside, and, you know, sort of an alternative lurking in the background who people seemed to like, who had been a deputy whip, was Denny Hastert. But Hastert came up with something informally called the Hastert Rule, which was, we're not going to bring up anything for a vote unless it can pass with Republican votes alone, and we're going to do what the president wants us to do. So in a sense, all of the norms that we would expect to find in a Congress, divided government, united government, whatever it might be, that you're going to look for broad bipartisan agreement if you're going to make major policy changes, that you're going to take your rules seriously, that you're going to take ethical standards seriously, those were just going by the boards. And we wrote that in The Broken Branch. And at that point, I have to say, we did not hold back on criticizing Democrats either, who during their 40-year reign of power that ended in 1994, 40 consecutive years, had really grown complacent and a little corrupt and very condescending towards their Republican counterparts. They were not free of criticism, but it was pretty clear that it was the Republicans who were deciding that the norms of the institution and the norms of governance mattered less than the cult of the party. And it simmered for a while after that. There were some really bad times. It wasn't just Hastert. Some of your listeners who have been around for a while will remember Tom DeLay, who became the enforcer in the House, and they really threw out all ethical standards. But, you know, by 2012, it was very clear to us as we watched what had happened with the Republican Party when Barack Obama became president and what followed from it, that we were really descending into an abyss, and that it was, as that piece said, that the Republicans were the problem.
I remember reading about media coverage or the lack of media coverage of your book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, in 2012. I mean, the Washington Post did print an adapted essay from the book, but can you just tell us overall, did you do many interviews? Did you get many book reviews?
You know, that piece in the Post, in the Outlook section, no longer is there an Outlook section, with an excerpt from the book, our editor, Carlos Lozada, who's now moved to the Times, titled it, let's just say it, The Republicans Are the Problem. And it really went viral. Mm-hmm. And it moved us to the New York Times bestseller list almost immediately. I don't think we would have gotten there without that essay, for just the reason that you've suggested. Most news media, and especially television, cable and network news, were aghast, because if they put on people who said that the problem was more on one side than the other, they were going to go run afoul of their own way of a frame of looking at the world, and of course get a lot of criticism for having a liberal or partisan bias. And they have, you know, basically dealt with criticism of having a liberal bias by moving to having, in effect, a conservative bias. We did get reviewed in the Post and the Times, but to be frank, we didn't get the kinds of placement that the attention more broadly given to the book would have suggested. And the Times review ran on like page 12 of book review section, which was sort of an indication that, yeah, it's important, but not that important. The Post, pretty much the same. And with the Times, what we were really hoping for was an interview from Mikoko Kukatani, who was then their book review editor during the editions during the week, which actually often would get more attention. And that never happened. More significantly, the Sunday talk shows just basically treated us like non-persons. They wanted nothing to do with us.
On today's Your Call, we are spending the hour with Norm Ornstein. He's been studying Washington politics and Congress for more than 50 years. He's contributing editor for The Atlantic, co-host of the podcast Words Matter with Dr. Kavita Patel. In 2012, he co-wrote a book called It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Norm Ornstein and his co-author, Thomas Mann, wrote, in our past writings, we've criticized both parties when we believe it was warranted. Today, however, we have no choice but to acknowledge that the core of the problem lies with the Republican Party. In 2017, Norm co-wrote another book with Thomas Mann and E.J. Dionne called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls, but we will definitely have Norm back so you can ask a question or have a chat with him about all the work that he's done. Norm, before we dive in more and talk about how we got to this place with the Republican Party, can we spend some more time talking about the media? Because you describe what happened in 2012 with the media. And when you look at where we are today, the both sidesism is still there, even after 4 years of Trump and after everything that they have said and done. How do you explain this? I mean, I've been watching some of the, well, actually a lot of the convention coverage. I was shocked by the coverage after the attempted assassination. I mean, many in the major media on the cable shows acted like this political violence came out of nowhere. What explains this?
It's deeply frustrating. One part of it, and I have some, I can't say deep sympathy, but a little bit of understanding. Media are trained and used to dealing with typical or normal situations. And when you have an abnormal situation, it's really hard to figure out how to alter that frame. One of the ways they've done it with the presidential campaign is that instead of focusing on the stakes of the election or the implications of what Trump has openly said, they fall back on the horse race and the polls. That's not new, but it's been taken to a much greater length now. And what we're seeing is occasional toes dipping into the idea of what this would be like in another Trump term, but mostly it's normalizing the abnormal. And at the same time, you know, I'll come back to it here. One little interesting thing, I haven't talked to them directly, but you have probably seen, and many, I'm sure, of the listeners have, the flap going on with NBC and MSNBC, which, without telling the hosts in advance, MSNBC took a program that is among its most popular, Morning Joe, and basically said, first couple of days of the convention, we're not going to run it in the morning. We're going to do a live news kind of thing. Why? The word that came out was because they were afraid that one of the many guests that go on Morning Joe, which is a four-hour show in the morning, would say something that would antagonize and make angry the Republicans while their convention was going on. And if that's how the news media are going to react, self-censorship to avoid a backlash, it is a level of cowardice, especially when, you know, the country's future is at stake. That is appalling. Now, you know, having said that, it's not new. It is a willingness to kowtow to the worst instincts and the threats that can come. And watching a White House press corps that basically sugarcoated a lot of what happened during the Trump administration, even as he repeatedly called them the enemy of the people. And I will remind listeners, some of them may not know this, but the term enemy of the people was originated by Stalin to use to justify eliminating his rivals and his enemies and a whole lot of populations. And when Nikita Khrushchev became the head of the Soviet Union, he banned the use of the term because it was too dangerous. Trump revived it for the news media, and instead of being alarmed and reacting against it by reporting on what his administration was doing and what he was saying, they treated him and his team as normal for the most part. And they're doing it again. Look at what Donald Trump has been saying. And one of the things that is so striking is if you look at most dictators or would-be dictators, when they're running for office or trying to get there, I'll use one of Trump's favorites who just visited with him at Mar-a-Lago, Viktor Orban of Hungary, as an example. Orban rose to power with an election in which he basically promised to be a normal and typical leader, following through with the norms of governance in a democratic Hungary. Once he got there, he dismantled the institutions and created an effective autocracy. Donald Trump hasn't done that. Trump has said directly that he would create a vicious autocracy. He has said that he would be dictator on day one. He said that he would fire the generals in the Defense Department who wouldn't go along with his illegal or unconstitutional acts and replace them with flunkies who would, that he would invoke the Insurrection Act, a piece of legislation that goes back more than a century for what is supposed to be a major domestic uprising, a kind of revolution taking place, and he would use the military to quell it, that he would create these detention camps for 12 million migrants or more who he has called animals, that he would get rid of key civil servants who are protected under the law by using a device called Schedule F and replace them with pliant people and flunkies. And then you look at Project 2025, which is a frightening 900-page playbook that has been put together by the Heritage Foundation in close connection with Trump's campaign, that his campaign team have said is their playbook, that he praised as the playbook when he first began to run and when they first began to put this together, and his lie that he didn't know anything about it. Of course, it was kind of amusing because he said, "I don't know anything about it, but I don't agree with much of it." In fact, is the playbook that would basically impose a complete abortion ban, that would move to ban most of contraception in the country, that would roll back gay marriage and attempt to roll back the legalization of gay sexual relationships. It goes on and on, not just eliminate the Department of Education, but take away all the funding for poorer schools and communities. All of that is out there in the public. And you really have to search to find significant references to it in our mainstream media. The New York Times, to its credit, did an editorial on why Trump was unfit to be president that basically, when it came out in the print edition on Sunday, went into a significant amount of detail. But if you do this as one-offs, or you do pieces on occasion pointing to the implications, but they're not in the front page above the fold, and that for the Times or the Washington Post, they're the signals to the rest of media about what's important and what needs to be covered and what needs to be covered in a sustained way, then you're giving a pass to people and you're suggesting that it's not really that important. And the coverage of the convention mostly has suggested that, yeah, it's a lot of words, a lot of rhetoric, but you know, the safeguards that we have in place, not to worry. And that's just simply wrong. And if we can't count on a free, aggressive media to deal with this, and to deal with it with the same intensity that they've dealt with Joe Biden's age and meltdown at the debate, then our problems become even greater.
Norm, we started a series on Project 2025. We're airing it every Wednesday. And you can find those shows at kalw.org. Click on news, and then you'll see your call there. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're spending the hour with Norm Ornstein. He's been studying Washington politics and Congress for more than 50 years. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so we cannot take your phone calls, but we will definitely have Norm back soon. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we're spending the hour with Norm Ornstein. Back in 2012, he co-wrote the book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. An essay adapted from the book ran in the Washington Post. That piece was called, Let's Just Say It, The Republicans are the problem. Well, another problem is that the book just didn't get the media coverage it deserved back then. In 2017, Norm co-wrote another book with Thomas Mann and E.J. Dionne called One Nation After Trump, a guide for the perplexed, the disillusioned, the desperate, and the not yet deported. Norm, we were talking about media coverage and what's really happened to the media, why they aren't really telling the truth about what we're truly facing here. And you mentioned the Morning Joe show, which got pulled from MSNBC on Monday morning. It was fascinating because Joe Scarborough went on the air and said, hey, if you do this again, you might not have a host. A lot of people are sharing an excerpt from Timothy Snyder's book on tyranny. And in his chapter, Do Not Obey in Advance, it says, most of the power of authoritarianism is freely given. In times like these, individuals think ahead about what a more repressive government will want and then offer themselves without being asked. A citizen who adapts in this way is teaching power what it can do. What are your thoughts on all of this?
You know, I've been reading books. Probably crazy to do it because it's not good for my digestive system about the rise of Hitler. And of course, you know, for years we said you can't make those comparisons. That's off base. But when you look at what happened in the 1920s in Germany, what Tim Snyder wrote resonates all too much. Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who's another one who studied all of this, reinforces it. And frankly, one of the things that I'm seeing now, what we saw back then, it's not just a press that doesn't treat this kind of rhetoric seriously, even though experience tells us that it should be taken in a deadly serious way. But we're also seeing, as we saw in Germany, the business community deciding that their tax rates and deregulation are worth more to them than maintaining the constitutional system and democracy. It's particularly true of some of those that I call, not pulling any punches, greedy and traitorous billionaires. If you noticed, Elon Musk is now pledged to give $45 million a month to help out the Trump campaign. We have billionaires like Steve Schwarzman of the Blackstone Group, David Sachs, and so many others, Bill Ackman, who have basically said, you know, Trump is going to help with this system. Don't worry so much. And it's very clear that from their perspective, they're behind gated communities. They're going to be all right. But Trump is going to keep their tax rates down. And he's not going to repeal those tax cuts that gave them so much back when he was president that end up expiring in 2025. There are too many forces in the society, from the media and you know, institutions, civil institutions that we rely on, that are given into this. And in some instances, it's out of ignorance or out of an unguided optimism. In some instances, it's out of fear. For some of the Republicans who know better, it is the fear of being shunned or excommunicated or, frankly, of having threats of violence take over for you. And we also have a news media that we've talked about and we could continue talking about. That is, for a while I was saying they're sleepwalking towards autocracy. They're actually joining the march and moving in that direction. And we haven't begun to talk about the governing institutions. The Supreme Court is a disaster right now, ignoring the law and precedent, writing its own constitutional dictates. The decisions that we saw just a couple of weeks ago, the mind-boggling decision that gives a president complete immunity for official acts and defines those official acts widely. And that includes the specific mention, the first official act that they said was the pardon power. And what they've in effect said, Chief Justice Roberts, joined by five of his colleagues, is that if a president bribes somebody with a pardon, takes money for a pardon, or says to somebody, I want you to commit an illegal act And don't worry, I will pardon you, especially if it takes place in the District of Columbia, because only the federal government can prosecute that, and you don't have to worry about it because I will pardon you. But that's okay. You know, when this issue was discussed and briefed and had the oral argument in the D.C. Circuit, the D.C. Court of Appeals, one of the judges asked the Trump lawyer who called for complete immunity, which most thought was just farcical. So this means that the president could call up SEAL Team 6 and say, go ahead and assassinate one of my rivals. And he backed off a little bit, but now the Supreme Court has said yes. So we can't count on the courts to provide the portion of the safety net we need. Congress has done nothing to deal with illegal acts and unethical acts by its own members, much less by the Supreme Court, where we have more corruption from justices Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito than we've ever seen throughout our history, and won't do anything about it. We can't count on Congress, certainly if it's a Republican Congress. So we've got a problem, and this is so parallel to what we've seen in the rise of other autocracies that it's chilling, to tell you the truth. And, you know, when Tom and I wrote It's Even Worse Than It Looks, we knew it was bad. We did a paperback version the next year, said it's even worse than it was. We knew it would get worse, but the idea that we're on the doorstep of an autocracy that could either resemble Orban's Hungary, where you have what I would say is a Potemkin village of institutions. You have a semblance, at least a surface of free elections, but they are genuinely rigged, unlike the fair elections that Trump called rigged, so that there's no way that Orban or his party can lose. Where you have what appears on the surface to be an independent court system, but the judges all inevitably side with the dictator, the leader, where you have a press that is ostensibly free, but any time they speak up in opposition to Orban or any of his actions, somehow the editors, the publishers, the owners are faced with punishing tax bills or are charged with offenses that come out of nowhere, and either they go out of business or they learn that they have to do the bidding of the leader. That's one model. And, you know, Trump has Orban and fets him at Mar-a-Lago this past week. Then we know that the Conservative Political Action Committee, which is really the sort of umbrella group of right-wing organizations, gave him their top awards, have gone to Hungary to laud his leadership. And guess who spoke out very favorably about Viktor Orban? J.D. Vance. Or you get a worse model, which is the Putin model or the Sisi model, one that is much more overtly vicious. And if those are the prospects that we possibly could face, and that you'd have to say right now are at least an even chance of occurring.
Today, we are spending the hour with Norm Ornstein, who's been studying Washington politics and Congress for more than 50 years. We're sorry, but we cannot take your phone calls. This is a pre-taped Your Call, but we will definitely have Norm back soon. Norm, I want to talk about how we got here and just the fact that there's so many layers to all of this. This year marks 20 years since Republicans last won the popular vote. So we have one of the most undemocratic systems in the world, according to Steve Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. They lay this all out in their book, Tyranny of the Minority, with the Electoral College. So that's an issue. And then, of course, you have gerrymandering. But the fact is, Democrats, I mean, it's so interesting because on the one hand, they're losing to extreme Republicans. On the other hand, in many cases, they're not losing. It's just that we have the Electoral College. So Hillary Clinton gets more votes than Trump, but she loses. But still, the Democrats hardly ever talk about the Electoral College. So given that you have been doing this work for decades, can you also talk about where the Democrats went wrong? Why are they losing to some of the most extreme Republicans we've ever seen?
So you're right, certainly, that a part of this is the structural deficiencies of our system. And it's not just the Electoral College. It's also the construction of the Senate. And as you mentioned, the nature of the House. It's not where we expected to be when the framers put the system together, where the ratio of population between the smallest and largest states was about 10 or 12 to 1. And, they made all kinds of compromises to make states more significant. But when it's 70 to 1, we're in a different place. Let me just make one other broader note here, Rose, that we may or may not come back to. If we look down the road, even if we somehow manage to return to having two reasonable parties, we've got a crisis of legitimacy ahead without major constitutional reform. And here's a statistic I use all the time now that is telling. We are almost at a point, we will be probably in just a couple of years, where 70% of Americans will live in just 15 of our 50 states, 50% living in just 8 of the 50 states. Now, we know why that's happening. People move to where the jobs are, and in a global economy, the engines of economic growth and jobs are the bigger states. They're in the big metropolitan areas. Two-thirds of our GDP comes from those big major metropolitan areas. But think about what that means. You're right. Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes and lost. Al Gore got a half a million more votes and lost. If you go back through the 44 elections before that 2000 election, you had one or maybe two instances where you could argue that the winner of the popular vote lost the presidency. Then we had two out of five. We haven't had one since, but you go from a half a million plurality by Al Gore to 3 million by Hillary Clinton. Joe Biden won the popular vote by 7 million, but the fact is, the Electoral College margin, which was a significant one, he only got by an eyelash, less than 100,000 votes, and he could have lost with a 7 million vote margin. And the fact is, we're going to have more of those elections. When we saw this happen in 2000, and that, of course, was in some ways the limiting case, highly controversial, 36 days to resolve it, and then resolved by a partisan 5-4 vote in the Supreme Court. But the country basically said, somebody's got to decide it. And those are the rules. It's like a tennis match. It's not the number of games you win, it's the number of sets. And we moved on, more or less. The second time, we didn't move on quite so much. The third time, assuming we continue to have presidential elections, the fourth time, the sense of legitimacy in the system is going to be deeply eroded. And this belief that we're not being governed by those we elect is going to be disintegrating. But take it to the next level. 30% of Americans, if 70% live in 15 states, 30% are going to elect 70 of the 100 US senators. And they don't represent the diversity of the country, much less the economic dynamism. It's not that the small states are all red and the big states are all blue. You got Delaware and Maine, for example, among the small ones, and you got Texas and Florida among the big ones. But if you don't have that representation, and if people believe that they're casting votes and they don't count, I know the argument against, which is this is a republic, it's not a democracy, it's a republican form of democracy, and that means people elect their representatives who represent them. If you elect representatives and they aren't able to represent you, you don't have legitimacy. The House is supposed to be the body that is re responsive right away to the public. The framers actually thought about having one-year terms instead of two-year terms. But, look at how responsive it is when 90% of Americans want background checks for guns and it goes nowhere in the House. When the overwhelming majority of Americans across every line want to see significant reform of the border, we get a bipartisan bill that actually passes the Senate with almost three-fourths of the senators voting for it. The House won't even bring it up, and it doesn't seem to result in any backlash because of the way the districts are designed. So we've got that big problem. Now, Democrats, I have to say to their credit, did vote in the House when they had the majority overwhelmingly for a major reform bill in the beginning of the Biden administration that would have altered the voting system to protect the vote, that would have begun to reform the process so we could have more ability to act on issues that matter and to be more representative. And it got filibustered in the Senate. Now, filibustered in the Senate because Democrats had only the 50 votes and they didn't have 50 willing to alter the rules through an unusual process, but one that has now been used several times. And that was, of course, right at the beginning because of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. But frankly, what we're also seeing now is the mantra that Michelle Obama came up with, when they go low, we go high, doesn't work. It's like, to use the cliche, it's like bringing a toothbrush to a sword fight or a gunfight. And the unwillingness to be able to move together to enact some of these reforms, because Democrats say we're going to play by the rules and people will embrace that. And it's what we've seen, for example, in the failure of the Senate Judiciary Committee to try the way they should have to hold Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito accountable, including by subpoenaing them. Even if those subpoenas fail, you should be able to act. It's not bringing ethics charges against members of the House and Senate who were complicit in a violent insurrection in the Senate, people like Ron Johnson. Just circling back for a second to the media, the Washington Post just brought in Ron Johnson, who is a Russian sympathizer who lied about his very direct involvement in that insurrection on January 6th. And they just hosted him for a major event, which, gives legitimacy. Yes, he's a senator. Yes, if they're in the majority, he would be a chair. But you're basically whitewashing the actions that people like that have taken. And Democrats do that over and over again. They're not basically up to the task of fighting against a very determined opponent that will use any tactics, ethical or not, legal or not, to achieve its ends. And you don't want them to go down to a level where they also will do horrible and unethical or illegal things, but you want to be able to highlight the depredations that are out there, including by other institutions, and make the case for why this is awful, and they haven't done a very good job of it.
Well, and also, Norm, you know this because you're so closely connected to what goes on in DC. I mean, the thing I think about a lot is the climate crisis, the issues I think about a lot, the climate crisis, and the fact that we have so many people in this country who are barely making ends meet. I mean, according to the Poor People's Campaign, there's 140 million people in this country who are poor or low income. And in many cases, the Democrats have lost these people.
Absolutely. Although I will say, I want to give a little credit to Joe Biden and to Democrats in Congress for that first 2 years when they had the majorities, and even if they faced filibusters and, of course, just having the narrowest margin possible in the Senate and a handful of slack in the House with the extraordinarily close margin, that they were able to accomplish an extraordinary amount. One of the things that they did was to pass that child tax credit that actually cut child poverty in half, doing more with that one act than the entire Lyndon Johnson war on poverty had been able to do over decades. But then it expired, and they were unable to bring it back. And they did provide a lot of safety net protection. But it's been chipped away at, and in many states, the more radical governments have undercut it. And the willingness and ability to fight against that is not what we would hope it would be. But it's very hard to do when you don't have the bodies and you don't have the numbers, and you're facing a party that doesn't want to solve problems, and especially now that wants to create more chaos because they believe, with some justification, that it'll be blamed on the president, which means it'll be blamed on Biden or blamed on Democrats out of the belief that they're the ones running things, even though we have a Republican House that is an extraordinarily radical House.
And to your point, Norm, the other problem is that for people who don't know how this system works, they become very angry. Why aren't you getting this done? I hear this over and over again. And then they either check out, they don't vote, or they might turn to Trump.
Yeah, and that's something that Trump has been counting on. One of the things that I'm very concerned about, and I've raised this with people in both the White House and in Congress, you know, they did a spending deal. The Speaker, Mike Johnson, after the embarrassments that the House Republicans have had, ousting Kevin McCarthy, not being able to find a speaker, finally ending up with one. And Johnson averted a couple of catastrophes out of a belief that it would hurt Republicans, avoiding a default and avoiding a shutdown by getting agreement to a deal. He had to do it by this extraordinary device of bringing these matters up under a rule called suspension, where it takes two-thirds to make it happen. And it was Democrats who made it happen with a minority of Republicans. And basically, the other Republicans in the House have told Mike Johnson, you've done this twice, you're not going to do it a third time. But the deals that they've reached expire on spending on October 1, 5 weeks before the election. And it's entirely possible that we're going to get a shutdown. Now, if the election, who knows what's going to happen in coming weeks and whether we will face a contest between Donald Trump and Joe Biden or whoever it may be, if it looks close enough, I think there is a very real chance that we will have more chaos with a shutdown beginning on October 1, with Republicans triggering it out of a belief that it'll be blamed on Biden and there will be some chaos. Mm. And one thing we know about a shutdown, Rose, is that it hurts the poorest among us more than anybody else.
Right.
There will be government workers who are not able to go to work and won't get paychecks, but when government reopens, they get reimbursed. The contractors, the people who clean the office buildings, who provide the security, will not get paid and they will never get reimbursed. And some of them may not be able to maintain their houses. They won't be able to pay the mortgages or pay their rent. For people out there working in businesses that are affected by a shutdown, they're the ones who are going to suffer. So there's a lot more to happen. And Democrats who really do have done more for working class Americans, for lower class Americans, for, you know, up against a party that basically doesn't care about their economic well-being, suffer for it because the broader set of values, particularly for white working class Americans, that have for them defined Democrats as evil and not representing their interests, in part because of the degree to which Democrats have, as part of their coalition, embraced minorities, people of color, and for other reasons, they suffer as a consequence. Democrats have not made the very good case of what they've been able to do. And most Americans are unaware that the child tax credit, the relief from student loans, the money that they got to help them in the aftermath of COVID and during the worst of COVID was done by Joe Biden and Democrats. And that's, unfortunate for them. And of course, now we're also seeing the infrastructure bill, which a whole lot of Republicans voted against. The ones who voted against it are going back home and congratulating themselves for what's gone to their states, even though they voted against it. And in many cases, they're going to get away with it.
Final thoughts, Norm. People are very frightened about this moment. A lot of people just cannot believe we are at a time when John Boehner, Paul Ryan, and Liz Cheney are no longer welcome in today's Republican Party. I mean, it's truly incredible. The daughter of Dick Cheney is no longer welcome in this party. Where do you see this going? I mean, we have no idea what's in store over the next couple of months. I'm just seeing a tweet here. ABC's John Carl Jonathan Carl is reporting that Senator Schumer had a one-on-one with Biden on Saturday and said it would be better for Biden and the Democratic Party if he were to bow out. So we have no idea where we're going to be even in a month from now.
No, we don't. And, you know, on that front, what may be the worst case scenario is if more and more Democrats in Congress openly call for Biden to withdraw and he doesn't. That's almost the worst case scenario, a deeply divided party with them reinforcing the idea that he's not up to the job. That would be bad, and it would, you know, there are many outcomes that could be very difficult for us to deal with. But, you know, getting to your larger point, Rose, and I want to make two points here. The first is, when Tom and I wrote It's Even Worse Than It Looks, we had a lot of Republicans out of office who came to us and said, thank you for trying to save our party. Republicans in office were not kind, and we lost friendships because the last message that they wanted out there was that this was a party that was, as we call them, an insurgent outlier. But the reality is, we were not against the Republican Party. We wanted and believed and do today that in a democratic system like ours, small d, we need two functioning parties. And they have to be functioning, problem-solving parties that respect institutions, laws, elections, and rules. And the Republican Party of that sort in this day and age would be a Liz Cheney kind of party, a very, very conservative party. But we're a long ways away from that, and that's the other point. When I look at the next generation of Republicans coming forward to serve in Congress, the farm team, as it were, the people who are now in state legislatures, who are party major party officials, and God help us, school boards now, they make the Freedom Caucus look mild by comparison. They are completely inculcated with what they're getting from talk radio and social media, much of which is promoting bizarre conspiracy theories. And, you know, they're all hot to imprison Tony Fauci. They're all with these plans in many states to criminalize wearing masks. And to get back to a point where we could have legitimate actors like Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney as the ones who are running for office and dominating is going to take a long time if, in fact, they lose this next election. If they win, and if they win, including the House and Senate, I do not believe that our democracy, as we know it, is going to be able to survive for a very long time. We have never seen the stakes so high in our lifetimes. The only time that we had stakes close to this and this high was in the pre-Civil War period. It's an existential moment in America. And even if we get past it this time, we got a lot of work to do, Rose. I mentioned one last thing, which is we do have a lot of reforms that could make a difference. We're nowhere close to having them, but we have to have them ready to go if we are lucky enough to be in a position to be able to implement them. I helped to put a lot of them together for the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And if you Google American Academy of Arts and Sciences, Our Common Purpose, there's a wonderful report you can get for free that gives 70-some suggestions for ways of making our political system work better. I hope they're not just theoretical and pie in the sky or discarded because they have no relevance for a political system that's abandoned democratic norms and institutions.
Norm Ornstein has been studying Washington politics and Congress for more than 50 years. He's co-host of the podcast Words Matter with Dr. Kavita Patel, contributing editor for The Atlantic, and co-authors of the books It's Even Worse Than It Looks and One Nation After Trump. Norm, thank you for your work. Thanks for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Absolutely, Rose. I really enjoyed it, and thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to Savannah Harriman-Pote for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Malihe Razazan for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
On the next Your Calls Media Roundtable, we'll discuss the media's failure to call out Trump and the GOP's extremist policies. Speakers at the Republican National Convention this week have used their platform to promote conspiracy theories, call for mass deportation of undocumented immigrants, and amplify their attack on LGBTQ people. What is the role of the media in shaping public opinion and political discourse? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.